What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. This week, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a break from TBRCon 2023 panels and instead share with you the audio of a live industry roundtable on indie bookstores. This panel featured indie booksellers Nicole Brinkley, JT Greathouse, Lily Rugo, Jean-Paul Garnier, and Meg Wasmer. It was so cool and honestly quite eye-opening to hear these five passionate booksellers delve into the ins and outs of indie bookstores, exploring the essentials of brick-and-mortar bookstores and bookselling, being part of a local book community, figuring out the best books to recommend for individual customers, developing relationships with publishers and authors, and much more. I hope by providing the audio of this roundtable here on the podcast feed will allow all of this incredibly valuable information to get out there into the hands of as many authors as possible. So, grab your notebooks, sit back, and enjoy.
Everybody who is joining us currently and will be joining us in the future as we are recording and resharing this live stream. I am Nicole Brinkley. I'm a bookseller at Oblong Books in Rhinebeck, New York, and I do a bunch of other things in a bunch of other corners of the internet, including hosting a podcast of my own. And I am so excited to have this wonderful group of sci-fi fantasy booksellers with me today to do a little industry roundtable on sci-fi fantasy bookselling. I could introduce everybody for them, but that's not nearly as much fun as letting them introduce themselves. So why don't we move in a circle? Meg, could you introduce yourself?
Hey, all. I am Meg Wasmer. I am one of the owners of Copper Dog Books in Beverly, Massachusetts. We are a general interest bookstore, but really a genre bookstore. So, you know, lots of genre love happening, yo.
JT?
Hi, I'm JT Greathouse. I'm a novelist and also a high school teacher and also a bookseller. I was a bookseller at Auntie's Bookstore here in Spokane, Washington for about 3 years full-time before I went into teaching. And even after I went into teaching, I haven't been able to leave, so I still work a couple nights a week. Just, you know, to keep my skin in the game of bookselling because it's fun in addition to being a job.
Jean-Paul?
I'm Jean-Paul. I'm the owner of Space Cowboy Books, which is a small bookshop in Joshua Tree, California, with a specialty in science fiction. Carry a little bit of everything, but the main focus is definitely science fiction. Also, we also run a small press publishing science fiction and related books, and run the Simultaneous Time Science Fiction podcast.
Keeping busy. And Lily?
Hi, I'm Lily. I'm one of the assistant managers at Harvard Bookstore, which is landmark indie in Harvard Square across from the university. Not affiliated. You can't buy t-shirts there. And we're mostly general interest, a lot of nonfiction, academic. But the booksellers, I think, hard carry the genre interest.
Now, this wonderful live stream is being hosted by FanFi, and specifically the Sci-Fi Fantasy Addicts podcast, which, if you are listening to this in podcast form later, hello again. Before we get into kind of the technical aspects of a new book selling and kind of like going into the nitty-gritty of it, what books made you all fall in love with sci-fi fantasy? You can't see it because the light is not as good in that corner, but I do have an entire bookcase of Anne McCaffrey books over that away. And I am curious as to what started each of your love of sci-fi fantasy.
I can start that one. So for me, it would have been when I was like, I don't know, in fourth or fifth grade. The elementary school library had pretty much the entire run of K.A. Applegate's Animorphs books. And I just started from the first one, and I just sort of didn't stop until I had pretty much read them all. And from there, I sort of developed an insatiable hunger for science fiction. And then the thing that made me really fall in love with fantasy was Brian Jacques' Redwall series, which I read about the same time. And then from there, I read A Wizard of Earthsea by Le Guin. And that was the one that like really sank the sort of eternal love for the genre in me. Like Redwall was super fun. Earthsea was where I was like, wow, you can do crazy things in genre. Like you can do interesting stuff with these concepts. So.
Unfortunately, my answer is The Boy Who Lived. Read that as a child, and that stuck with me through most of my childhood. And then after that, the teen years were, you know, the standard Twilight, Cassandra Clare diet that sustained me for a while. But also, not book related, but anime. I grew up with a love for anime, and I was able to find those mechanics and that like sense of adventure in fantasy books, and that's sustained me through.
For me, it was the Tripod Trilogy by John Christopher. I read those when I was a little kid. He's a British writer. It was written in the 60s, YA sci-fi, and that I want to say that got me hooked, but I actually drifted away from science fiction after that into classic literature. And then in my late teens, early 20s, I found Vonnegut and Frank Herbert and really fell in love with their stuff. And then found writers like J.G. Ballard. And then it was just off the deep end for me and never went back.
Star Wars, Darth Vader coming on to like the through the door and, you know, A New Hope. Kevin J. Anderson pretty much taught me to read. I was in a grocery store. My mom bought me my first Star Wars novel. I had a great teacher in eighth grade who was like, I see you like intellectual properties. Can I give you some original content? And actually gave me David Eddings, speaking of Spokane. So The Belgariad, don't recommend, doesn't age well, but we can have our problematic favorites.
So some of us here work at general bookstores, some, given away by Space Cowboy, work at more genre-specific bookstores. What are some of the joys and challenges of hand-selling and carrying science fiction and fantasy? Both, and you can answer this both to like general fans and consumers, but also like if there's any writers in the audience that you want to kind of give little nudges to about what the challenges are, you can go ham. I'm going to throw this one to Lily to start, even though the furrow of her eyebrow suggested she needed a second to think.
So I guess the easy part is there's a lot of fantasy that's accessible in mainstream. So you can go like, oh, if you like Game of Thrones, here's this. If you like the MCU, here is this. So there, you know, a lot of people. I'm not old as a person, but I'm old among my staff, so I'm convinced I'm ancient. But a lot of people my age grew up with Harry Potter and things like that, or the Cassandra Clares. So the perk is there's a lot of comps that people either like grew up with and can like relate to and reach to right away. So that was the easy part. That's what I can think of. The hard part, I think, is convincing people to read the chonky, the huge fantasies, because like, why would I read that when I can just watch Game of Thrones? Or I feel like, oh, I'm too stupid for sci-fi, which is the camp I fall into. So it's convincing people to like really dedicate their time to sci-fi and fantasy, I think, in my opinion, off the top of my head, when it's both super accessible, but also like, the books feel inaccessible, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think both a joy and a challenge is trying to convince people to step a little bit outside their comfort zone, kind of like what Lily's talking about. So like a book that I really loved that came out this year or late last year, I forget off the top of my head, was The Mountain in the Sea by Ray Naylor, which is science fiction, but it's also very literary, and it's very interested in not just like its science fictional concepts, but also its you know, delivery of character, and it's on a prose level very, very, very well written. And so I think there are people who don't read science fiction who read for those things who would really love it. And so sometimes somebody will come into the store and they'll, you know, be looking for a book and they're not really sure what they want. And so I ask them questions to try to figure out, what do you really look for in a book? And if it turns out that what they really look for is, you know, really, really well realized characters and really, really technically good prose, I'll be like, well, you should check this out. It's, you know, it's science fiction, but it's also very literary. You'll probably like it. And that can be tough because they're, you know, you get that reaction of like, oh, well, I don't really read sci-fi. And then, you know, as uncomfortable as it makes me to say, well, it's not, you know, pew pew laser gun science fiction, I will use that line to try to convince somebody who might, you know, not want to read it because they're thinking Star Wars, when this is more like, you know, it's more like My Octopus Teacher, the novel, than it is Star Wars. So
I would read a novel version of that. Yes.
I think that, like, in my 17 years of bookselling, this is possibly the easiest time I've ever had selling sci-fi and fantasy. I will say my biggest challenge is people who will come in and the Night Circus is, like, my kryptonite. The Night Circus is my favorite book. I don't read fantasy and I don't read romance. Well, friend, have I got some news for you? And, like, breaking down this barrier that people have built to entry. Like, you're here. Like, you are one of us, and it's okay. Like, but this kind of guttural reaction of, I read literary fiction, or I read fiction. Like, an internal bias that they don't realize they have, but they're already one of us. Like,
on the flip side of that, though, another thing I've run into, because as you say, there are a lot of people now who are reading fantasy and science fiction, more so certainly than like 5 years ago, even. But a thing I run to is people who only know of like three or four things, and then they come in and that's their entire frame of reference, which kind of makes it hard to like figure out what to suggest next. Like, I get a lot of people who come in and they like know the Kingkiller Chronicle, because that's huge. They know Game of Thrones, and they know like Lord of the Rings. And that's not really, that doesn't triangulate to anything. So then trying to help them figure out what they might like next can be kind of tough. But also there's a lot of opportunity there to like just foist your favorites on them, which is always fun.
For me, one of the greatest joys is, you know, I've worked in all different kinds of businesses, food, for instance, everybody eats, but not everybody reads. And so people that come into a bookstore are generally book people. And, you know, we already have something in common that we both love. And that always leads to amazing conversations where we exchange information. I learn so much from my customers, and that's always a wonderful experience. I think one of the greatest challenges in a genre bookstore is there, like everyone has mentioned, there's a stigma against science fiction that it is somehow a subliterate genre, which is the impression comes from watching 1950s movies that has very little to do with the literature itself. I get it from the movies. I mean, they're terrible, right? But fun, but usually terrible. But that ties into another great reward of breaking down that stigma with customers and being like, oh, you like literary fiction. Well, have you read Walter Tevis? Have you read Ursula K. Le Guin? Have you read Miller Jr.? You know, there's all these incredible literary science fiction writers that a lot of people just haven't associated or made the connection that it is science fiction. So that's really exciting. And just connecting with the customers in that way. Hey, the time traveler's wife made me weep. And they go, oh, well, you're willing to talk about crying, and I want to cry when I read, too, and then connecting over that. For authors, I think one thing that's probably good for authors to know, a challenge in any small bookstore is series. Everyone buys book one, and you end up, you know, on the shelf with, oh, there's book 4, 8, and 12 over there, and everyone's looking for book one or two. I find that particularly challenging when I'm working with indie authors because they often want me to carry their whole large series, and I want to, but I'm in a tourist area, so a lot of the customers aren't going to return necessarily. And so it can be very tricky to stock past book two for that reason.
Yeah, so as an author, like that's a thing that I discovered while working in a bookstore, is just a series is really not strategically the way to go if you're you know, looking to be on an indie bookstore shelves. Shelf space is expensive. And like trying to like you're used to going into the store and seeing like Robert Jordan command an entire shelf, right? The reason he does that is because those sell and like he's a huge name. Your 10 book series statistically is not going to sell enough to command an entire shelf. So like understanding that like getting your first couple books in the store is what's likely to happen, like the first couple in the series if it's doing okay, and then the rest of it people will just need to special order, because as cool as it is to have a 10 book series on the shelf, most people don't get that.
Yeah, what we do, especially the only one that comes to mind is the children's series, Wings of Fire. There's like 12 or 14 of these things. And we have a fairly large children's section, tourist area, family area. So we try and fit 1 through 14 on our shelves, but a lot of the times we'll have like 1 through 3 and then just pull out 8 through whatever, and then we'll have like 13, 14. Because we figure like they're in the store and, you know, they sell and they're popular. But if a kid is on book 9, they're going to come up and ask for it. We have to do the same thing with like Wimpy Kids and other things.
Our store also does the like carry the first one or two, and then like whatever the newest one is, we'll get that in. We've already talked about a lot of like delicious stuff that I want to break into a little bit. And one of those things is that idea of not necessarily the stigma around sci-fi fantasy, but that people don't realize they're already reading it, right? Like we talk about Aaron Morgenstern. One of the things I've started doing recently is I've started putting The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue in our general fiction section. And then when people go, oh, I love that, I want to read the rest of her books, I go, oh, they're around the corner in sci-fi fantasy, and I start luring them over. What are some of the authors and books for all y'all that work really well as kind of those breakthroughs, or when you're having those conversations with customers that you can blow their mind and be like, oh, that's technically fantasy, that's technically science fiction? Like, I love to do that to people who really liked Exit West, to be like, oh, by the way, that's technically, that has a fantasy element, that's technically a fantasy book. What are those books for y'all?
I'll give everyone time to answer, but what you, real quick, what you said is really interesting, because it's true of sometimes we're supposed to like lead the customer like to the bookshelf and be like, oh, here's the book. When they see you pull it from fantasy, they have a different reaction when you pull it from fiction.
I play the long game.
So like for me, the one that I keep, well, not necessarily so much right now, but there was a solid 2-year period where Station 11 was the book that everyone had read that was technically science fiction and that they hadn't connected to science fiction. And then from there, you could recommend, you know, other post-apocalypse books or other books that were, you know, in that sort of same literary-ish sci-fi, like mainstream fiction slash sci-fi vein, and kind of get them into the genre that way. One of my go-tos for trying to convert people to fantasy is if somebody's telling me that they like historical fiction, but they've already read like all the Bernard Cornwell and stuff, I'll recommend Guy Gavriel Kay, because it's like pretty light on the fantasy elements, but it is fantasy and it is secondary world. But it is written in a way that I think people who like literary historical fiction can connect with. It's in that kind of vein. And that's worked pretty well for me a few times. I've definitely converted a few people to at least reading Guy Gavriel Kay, if not all fantasy.
A really good crossover for me, and I actually stock it in the literature section and in the science fiction section, is Margaret Atwood. And it's funny you bring up Station 11, because that's one of those, you know, another one of those authors that doesn't want to be connected with science fiction, but, you know, wins the awards, and it is a science fiction book, whether they like it or not. But a lot of times those bridges are authors that write both, like, you know, in the horror section, people will be looking at Dan Simmons, for instance, like, well, he wrote some amazing science fiction as well. Kurt Vonnegut is another great crossover in that oftentimes people don't think of as science fiction. Even authors like William Burroughs, that people, you know, they go, oh, Naked Lunch, this crazy stuff. But he wrote a few science fiction novels as well that are really weird. Shirley Jackson, authors like that, where I'll actually have the books in both sections. And when I see someone taking an interest in the literature section, I'll go, hey, come on over here and find out there's more.
We've been pulling people in. I have a bookseller that loves Outlawed. I cannot remember the author's first name. Last name's North. It's
Hannah.
Thank you. And then I throw Upright Women Wanted at them, and then I lure them into American Hippo. Like, it's, you know, again, the long game. I'm going to get you with the Westerns. I'm just going to make them ridiculous. Like, can I interest you in a hippo Western? Like, but I forget Station 11 sci-fi. Like, because can't sell it out of sci-fi. It has to be shelved in Lit Pick or people don't buy it in my store. It's, you know.
And yeah, it's a weird one where, like, the it's not a book that I think I would hand sell to people who read science fiction. And there are a lot of things like that where it's like, this isn't something that I would hand sell to you if what you're looking for is sci-fi. But if you've read it, you might like sci-fi, right?
So kind of thinking about that long game in terms of hand selling, one of the things that I love most about independent bookstores, it's my favorite part of my job. It's a lot of my coworkers' favorite part of their jobs. And I love doing it when I go to other bookstores, is that experience where you give a book you like and you get a recommendation, right? And part of that comes from the skill and joy of finding comp titles. Now, comp titles, if for some reason you are listening and you have no idea what a comp title is, it is just a book that you are comparing another book to. So if you tell a bookseller that you really liked Harry Potter when you were younger, but you're a grown up now and you want something to read, they might say that a great change of pace would be A Darker Shade of Magic because it has that fast-paced accessibility, but like actual queer characters and no turfy authors, right? So it is also a very helpful skill when it comes to writers, when it comes to querying books, right? Like, we're often told that authors need comp titles in order to sell their books. For all of you who have to not only do comp titles within sci-fi fantasy, but finding those comp titles from other things they might like a Western or like a classic novel, what do you think kind of the skills are in finding the correct comp titles? And what advice can you give to people trying to either figure out a comp title for their own books or when looking for book recommendations, how to kind of suss out what comp titles are the right ones for that? Big question, I know.
It's such a big question. I think it's looking for, it's less about like one-to-one comparison and more, you know, vibes. You know, like the best Game of Thrones comp isn't Name of the Wind. It's the best, you know, fantasy comp. But you really, if someone's in there for the political scheming, you actually want to give them Pillars of the Earth. Like, looking for the vibes. Like, did you like the fantasy or did you like the politics? Did you more dragons? I can give you more dragons. Like, you know, but yeah, it's vibes. Like, finding that little, like, finding the chink in their armor, the thing that makes them love the book rather than like, oh, it was a bestseller, so I bought it.
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's about asking follow-up questions with them. Like, what did you like about it, right? Like I was saying with the Ray Naylor example, if what you really like is prose style, then he's a very good prose stylist, so you should read his book. I think that from like the writer's perspective, comp titles are a very frustrating thing because you always want to comp to what inspired you, but that's not necessarily what's going to sell your book to someone. So for example, like when I was going out on submission with my series, my agent and later my editor to the marketing people wanted to comp to The Poppy War because my book is like similar in certain ways. It's like got a post-colonial bent to it and things like that. And that was just the big book that had those things in common with it that would communicate to people what my book was like in terms of like themes and in terms of, you know, where, who you would try to hand sell it to, even though I think that it's not a very coherent comp in terms of like some of the things Meg is talking about. Like the vibes are different. It's not quite as grimdark. It's not, it doesn't have the same kind of like tone to it. But if somebody comes in and says, I really like The Poppy War because I like things inspired by Asian history that have a coming of age element, then my book is a great one to go to. And that's kind of the attitude that I have in hand selling as well, is like, what is it that you want from the book that you're telling me about? What experience are you trying to recapture? Because with that, I can find a comparison. With just the title, I have, there's like, it could go like 1,000 different directions.
For those who are listening, I was just going to say, for those who are listening, you are not hallucinating the cat noise. JT has a very pathetic, upset cat in the background who wants to be let outside, but we're too busy doing a podcast recording.
I'm hoping Lily, please take it up and let her go. I can't get up.
Comps are great for book selling. And again, I operate entirely off of vibes, and it's easier, I think, with, because we're so close to a lot of college students and like young adult readers. I really get into the, like, what kind of music do you listen to? What movies or like TV shows? Do you like anime? Things like that. So you can kind of get vibes off of that. Like, I think, like, for me, K-pop is a big vibe recommendation of like, oh, you like these things. The difficulty with comps, especially if you're, then this is mostly going out to, like, I guess the writers and the publicists, especially for like marginalized voices, is if there's one big title, if you have like two elements about that title, that's just the go-to comp. And for me, the one that drove me nuts, and this is not a genre, sci-fi or fantasy, but Crazy Rich Asians was just the biggest movie. And then the book took off, even though the movie is actually surprisingly better. But for a very long period of time, if there was a single Asian family with dysfunction and some money, every book was suddenly comped to Crazy Rich Asians. So as a publicist, you absolutely have to look out for that, because that's inaccurate. You're not reading the original book correctly. You're probably not reading the book you're comping correctly. And that's mostly to publicists. But also, I think, is on the responsibility of booksellers as well.
And I would just throw a tip out to writers who are listening to this. When you are going on submission and sending queries to agents and stuff, that also applies. Like, you don't want to comp to the big mega bestseller that is kind of tangentially related to your book. You want to try to find comps from the last couple of years that genuinely do triangulate where your book sits in the market. It's, you know, you don't comp Game of Thrones just because everyone's heard of it. If you're comping it, there needs to be like a good coherent reason.
I do love kind of using comps in store when I'm not there, because I'll do like an, if you love, try these three things, and it's a great way to get books that maybe didn't have the same marketing budget in front of people and let them talk while I'm not there. It's one of the best things I brought from Borders, because I used to do them all the time.
One thing I find with customers that's super helpful, and this is kind of the opposite of a comp title in a way, is I'll often ask, what's a book that you really didn't like? And that'll narrow things down greatly. If I know one book they loved and one book they hated, it's like, okay, that tells me so much about your reading taste. And then this goes for indie authors that are trying to sell books to a bookstore or to the customer. Theme and mood are I want to know more about that than a book it might be like. For instance, a lot of my customers are on vacation and they want light reading, or they're in a mood, you know, they're seeing the Milky Way for the first time and they've been inspired. They want to know about aliens, you know, and so finding out where the person is at, you know, I sell tons of Octavia Butler, of course, and for damn good reason. But, you know, one question I'll always ask, someone's buying Kindred or something, hey, are you feeling fragile right now? If you are, you might want to wait a little bit, because this book's going to be a rough ride in the best of ways. But, you know, what kind of mood are you in? And making those kind of connections, you know, is this a book to read later? Is this a book I'm going to read tonight? I think that's important for connecting the customer with the book. And when dealing with an indie author that wants me to carry their book, I kind of want to know where I'm going to shelve it in that way. You know, in my new book section, it's not necessarily organized alphabetically. It's sometimes organized by mood. When people coming in asking for specific themes, you know, I want post-apocalyptic with a thread of hope. Okay, these are the books that you need.
I love the idea of that being a section header in a bookstore, like intensely specific. I will visit that section. one of the things I really love to do for comps is you want, and as a follow-up to what everybody said, you want the plot comp meets vibes comp, right? Like the plot is like this meets the tone of this. And that can usually hit both sides of the spectrum really fast. If you need to do comps, I'm a big fan of asking follow-up questions. Speaking of follow-up questions, I'm going to throw our question from our lovely friend, Adrian, who is normally the host of this incredible podcast, who had a question sent along from a friend and indie author, Tom Bookbeard. So we all do a lot of work with traditional publishers. So again, traditional publishing is someplace like Penguin Random House or Macmillan or Candlewick or Scholastic, both what are called the Big Five publishers. So the big ones based in New York City and smaller presses, but that are not necessarily authors putting out their own books. Tom wants to know, what are the best and nicest ways for independent authors to connect with booksellers and stores and get their books on shelves? I'm going to throw it to all of you, but I am going to throw out two things right away. One, if you contact us, don't link to Amazon. Two, if you are making your book distributable through a vendor like Ingram, make sure it's returnable. You might take a bigger hit on it, but it makes us way more likely to carry it because it means if for some reason it really does flop, we are not stuck with it forever. What are some advice y'all have?
You know, again, the don't link to Amazon when you're emailing me. You know, do have a good one sheet, and do include the ISBN of your book in your email. Title, author name, ISBN are the three things I need, and they get left out of that contact email, that first contact, incessantly. I get a lot of emails. I own a bookstore. Like, make it easy for me. Kind of lower that barrier of entry. You know, there are kind of standard terms as far as, you know, returnable, a set discount. I can work with a shorter discount than a traditional publisher. Does, as Nicole said, need to be returnable for me to gamble.
I worked as the consignment manager at Antes for a few years, which basically is the person who's getting the most indie books into the store, because we would take things in, not pay you for them, but then if they sold, pay after the fact. And it's kind of a way to get books into the store that aren't really accessible otherwise, like weren't distributed through Ingram or whatever. So I did a lot of interacting with local authors who were, you know, from very, very small presses or independent publishing, who did not have another way to get their books in the store. And a couple of things stand out to me as being like good strategies if you're trying to get your book in a store. One is just be a nice like person to interact with and don't be combative. So I had like one experience with somebody whose books we'd had in the store for about 9 months and we hadn't sold any of them. And I needed to return them because like if it's been on the shelf for 9 months and I haven't sold it, I'm probably not going to be able to sell it. And so I contacted him and I was like, hi, we need to return your books. Sorry about that, but you know, they're not selling. Can we set up a time for you to come in and pick them up and sign them, and I can sign them back to you and everything. And he just got really mad. Like, you know, like, why aren't you selling my books? You should be putting them on display, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, okay, I'm never going to work with you again because you're not pleasant to work with. And as much as like I want to support local authors, I also don't want to deal with assholes. So, you know, just be nice. That's a big one. On the other hand, we had an author who is a local dude who he's a poet and he brought in some poetry books and he was like really, really nice, just like super fun to talk to, just a great dude. And his books sell okay. They don't sell like spectacularly or whatever, but we like bend over backwards for this guy to put his stuff out on display and like, you know, do events with him and things like that, just because he's a great person to interact with. And so like being personable and being pleasant to do business with is a huge part of being a publisher that wants to work with bookstores. You want them to work with you, not just because like, because your product is not probably going to compete in terms of sales. but it can compete in terms of relationship. And so that's kind of, I think, the place to focus on if you're an independent person. Try to build good relationships with the people making decisions about where your book goes and how much effort to put into trying to sell it. Because there are so many books on our shelves. It's unreal. There are thousands. We can't hand sell all of them, but if you give us a reason to want to hand sell yours, we will try.
Yeah, the Amazon thing, I get an email every day. My book's available on Amazon. Please buy it. Those get deleted. I think one thing indie authors, a lot of them don't understand is the difference between retail and wholesale. If I buy your book at a retail price and I sell it at the price that's on the cover, I'm going to lose money on that sale. That would be a terrible business model. It has to be available for a wholesale price, which is generally 40%. 40% off the cover price. That's what we're going to get from Ingram and our distributors. So that's just a very basic understanding of any business if you want to sell something. ISBNs, as Meg said, super important. If you want to be in my bookstore, the best thing to do is send me an ARC. If I love the book, I'm going to be able to sell it. I'll probably put you on for an event, and you might even end up on my podcast if I really love the work. It's worth those couple bucks to get someone behind your book. Another mistake that I see a lot is authors will demand display space. Display space is the most valuable real estate in the bookstore, and I'm going to rotate what that stuff is. But if you demand to have it, you're not going to get it. That being said, there is a very overlooked thing in publishing, especially for indie authors. The cover is very important of your book, but more important than the cover, and this is never discussed, is the spine of your book. If you're not on display, it is going to disappear into those shelves and never be picked up. A printed spine alleviates that. It makes it easy for me to find it too, so that I can hand sell to a customer if I think it's the right connection. And yeah, don't be a dick. No one wants to work with a jerk, you know? Be friendly. We're here trying to do it. We're not going to make that much money off the sale of your book. But if I like your work, I will stick up for it and I will put it in people's hands. And I will reach for the indies first because I know they need the most help. And I'm an indie author myself. And I pride myself on the bookstore carrying a lot of books that you're not going to find in other bookstores because they're not books that that bigger booksellers will take a chance on. You know, I love that part of the store's focus is on indie authors, but the approach is incredibly important. Another mistake that I see a lot is someone will email me over and over and over again. I also edit for magazines, which means I'm having to respond to like 100 emails a day. If you've flooded my inbox like that, I'm probably going to delete them. Respect the time that it takes for the person on the other end to do this, and respect the fact that the bookseller is going to be spending money to buy your stuff. That's not a situation where demanding is going to work very well.
I'd add one more point, which is if your friends aren't local to you, get them to order it from your book from their local indie. One of the fastest ways to get on my radar is to have sales, so that if you're a big five published author and someone pre-orders your book before I've heard of it, I'm still going to order one more. If you're an indie pubbed author and someone's in ordering your book, you've now gotten my attention as the person who spends the money. Like, you know, so if you've got 10 friends in 10 different states and each of them go to their local indie, that is a much more organic reach than sending me an email that says, I think you should read my book. Like, talk to me with money, which is mercenary, but true.
That is also true for...
So sorry. One sheets came up. I almost never get these from authors. These are super helpful. Put it together. It only takes a couple minutes. And then once we carry your book, let people know it's available at that particular store. I find that often doesn't happen. An author will come in a couple months later and go, why haven't you sold any of my books? And my first question is, did you tell anyone they're available? And the answer is usually no, if there hasn't been sales.
The sales thing is especially true for larger. Harvard Bookstore is still independent, but our square footage, we're fairly large, and we're fairly mainstream and things like that. So if you whenever if we get, you know, indie sales all the time, but if one book particularly, we have like, especially over like a 2-3 week period, 5 people order it, we have to be like, wait, what's up with this one? And that's how we pay attention. Funny story about displays though, we've had a few, not even like indie, like Harvard professors, we've had tenured Harvard professors sneak in their books into our windows. Don't do that. That's insane, and your book might end up in recycling at that point. And at least, again, from a larger bookstore perspective, and I can't really talk much on this because I'm not one of the buyers at the store. I'm the opposite of you, Jean-Paul, of please don't bring your ARCs or physical books to the booksellers or the general information desk. Or if you do, you know, shoot your shot and they say no, don't push it on them, leave it on the counter, put it on the shelf. We've had that a few times because the booksellers are not the buyers. They can like, they might like, if your pitch is really cool and you're really nice, they might mention it to the buyers, but harassing the booksellers is not going to get you on the shelf. That's not their jobs. That's not their jurisdiction. And the worse you are about it, the worst impression you're going to make. And we're never going to carry your books, Harvard tenure or not. So just those few things.
Yeah, it's funny that Harvard tenured professors would do that. We had a guy who is also a professor, but at like the local university, Eastern Washington University, do that, where he came in and we were carrying his book and he like found it on the shelf and put it on a display. It's like, what are you doing? But so a quick anecdote of like how to do this super well that came to mind is Katie Robert. Mm-hmm. You may have heard of her. She's a local to Spokane. And before she like had super blown up, she was already kind of reaching out to us, letting us know that she existed, offering to sign books and have them mailed to people, you know, wherever through our store. And so we love her. Like we'll do whatever she wants. Like we'll have her in to sign stock. We'll have her do events, anything she wants to do, because she supports us by directing her fans to order from us if they want physical books. So if you have a fan base online that like wants your stuff and you have a local indie bookstore and you know, want to make them like you, then work with them and like point your readers to the bookstore that you want to work with.
Yeah, we all love books, obviously, or we would not be in this industry. But it is a business and everybody has to keep that in mind when it comes to what we're bringing into the store. And I think also like a really good point that we haven't mentioned is be strategic about what indie bookstores you are reaching out to. Like if they are your local bookstore and all your friends are around, like, yes, partner with them. If they're 3 hours away from you and you've been in there once and you're not going to do any work to get people into their store, it's probably not going to be a good fit. Are they a huge general bookstore or are they like a niche bookstore that's going to carry like other books exactly like yours? Doing the research rather than just throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping it'll stick is a better investment for you and a better investment in the bookstore. And also will allow that kind of more natural organic growth of, oh, it's doing really well there. Oh, that person mentioned it to this other genre specialist. Now this genre specialist mentioned it to a general bookstore. It allows that sort of spread because, as you can tell, clearly we all chat amongst ourselves. Almost knocked over my laptop. Let's not do that. I have a few broader industry questions, but before I go into that, I wanted to give everybody a chance to kind of plug another sci-fi fantasy or genre bookstore that they love, that they think is like absolutely nailing it, that both indie authors and traditional authors can go look at and kind of like suss out the landscape and admire, but that also all of us lovely readers can go shop at, besides each of your own bookstores, of course, which everybody should go and shop at and follow on respective social medias. We'll plug them at the end.
There's a place in... Go ahead.
Oh, so I was going to go first because my actual favorite bookstore, even better than the one that I work at, isn't genre specific, but they do absolutely incredible community work. It's Left Bank Books in St. Louis, Missouri. It was my hometown bookstore. It's where I fell in love with books and bookstores. They have a cat, in case you need any more publicity. But they, whenever people think of community, independent, like progressive bookstores, it is Left Bank Books, so I can't recommend them enough.
For genre fiction, there's a place in Berkeley called Dark Carnival that has one of the just most, I think they're still around. I heard they were having trouble, but you know, what bookstore isn't? Amazing. It's a mystery and science fiction bookstore. Their science fiction collection is just off the hook. And they have a comic book store a couple doors down too. So absolutely wonderful place. One of my favorite bookstores in the world, which is huge and has an incredible science fiction selection as well, is a place in North Hollywood called the Iliad. Just a phenomenal bookstore. It's been around since the 60s. It's one of those places you walk in and it's overwhelming. Where do I begin? But their science fiction section is incredible, and it's pretty cheap too. Cats, the whole deal. Amazing place.
Yeah, my hometown bookstore that I grew up visiting a lot was Adventures Underground in Richland, Washington, which is, you know, a small town in the middle of the desert. And they are kind of like the bright spot in terms of science fiction culture there and, you know, queer culture and things like that as well. And one thing they do that I think is really cool, and I wish more bookstores did, is they have like space for people to just sort of hang out and like play board games or read books. And like floor space is expensive, especially in bigger cities. So not everywhere can do that. But I, you know, I really appreciate how they try to not just sell books, but also be like a cultural space for people to hang out in, meet other people who are interested in the same things and things like that.
Not a genre specific store, but Title IX. Which city is Title IX in, Nicole?
I want to say it's in Westerly, but don't quote me on that. It's the sister store of Savoy and Bank Square Books, and all three are in different locations, so I don't remember which one is in which.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly where it is. It's a mission-driven bookstore with a focus on kind of social justice, lots of very, very good queer books. And I know for a fact that the manager loves spec fic. So there's, you know, they've got lots of good stuff for our people.
Lily, I hear you have another recommendation.
Yes, I did think of it. So in Cambridge, Mass, in Central Square, Pandemonium. So it's a board game store, and they have a lot of really excellent board games. They have like gaming meetups, but they've also recently expanded into this gigantic science fiction, science fantasy, and hang on. Anyways, they have what we're looking for. So if you go, I think it's on the bottom floor or stuff, but definitely check out Pandemonium if you're in the Massachusetts area.
And phenomenal events. They get like really, really good panels. Yeah, I don't believe I forgot Panda. Bad person.
I'm a mad woman, so I'm going to give three rapid fire recommendations. A Room of One's Own is a general bookstore, mission driven bookstore, but they give some of the best sci-fi fantasy recommendations. If you don't follow them on social media, you should. Their graphics are great. Escape Pod Comics in Huntington, Long Island. Talking about sci-fi fantasy, I cannot separate it from comics and manga. They are all too closely interlinked. And Meacham, who runs the store, has some of the best selection I've ever seen, with not just focusing on Marvel DC, but has so many independent creators in there. And then I visited Seattle, Washington for the first time this year and visited the University Bookstore, which is huge. And it is the first time in a very long time that I was finding things in their sci-fi fantasy section that I had never heard of before. And I spent literally my entire hour just in that section. I highly recommend. Okay. Now I want to think bigger. Now, these are stores that are doing it well. But the relationship between bookstores and publishers, independent, big five, somewhere in the middle, can be tumultuous because sometimes they do things that I don't understand, that we collectively get driven up a wall by. That could be pricing YA sci-fi fantasy at adult prices. That could be inexplicably putting only Christopher Paolini's name on the spine of his book and not the title, which I'm still mad about. It could be the merch that they send us, or just the books that they are choosing to push when clearly there are other things we love on the shelf. What kind of changes do you want to see in the publishing space that you think would be super beneficial to readers and independent bookstores in your dream world, besides, of course, them giving us better rates on books?
I have like 8,000. Oh, go ahead, Meg.
Okay, so there's a bookcase behind me over the side. That's all unread ARCs. I want every single advanced copy print on demand so that I can pick the books I want and not have it based on the marketing budget that you've assigned, thus letting me get some of the weird little like midlist stuff that you're never going to print an ARC for. That's what I want. I want to pick my own ARCs.
Yeah, ARCs are a big one. At one point at our store, we had, I think, 5 ARCs of Babel that they had just sent us unsolicited. And we didn't need that many. Like, we had like 2 people who were interested really in reading it, but they were pushing it so hard. They just kept flinging copies at us. And, you know, there are other books like that where it just feels like they're putting all of their money behind one thing. And I get why they do that. But at the same time, like, there are so many things that fly under the radar. Like, there's this book called When We Cease to Understand the World, which I really love, by Benjamin Labitude. And I would have hand-sold the hell out of it if I'd known that it existed when it came out. But I didn't read it until, like, 6 months after it came out, when another bookseller that I was friends with was like, hey, you seem like you would really love this. Have you read it? I was like, I didn't even know that it existed, because they didn't send us an ARC. They didn't send us any marketing copy. They didn't send us anything. And now I've hand sold like 100 copies of it since then. But, you know, like, I can't sell something if I don't know that it exists. And I already know that the book that you've sent me 5 ARCs of exists. So, like, send me 5 ARCs of different books instead of 5 ARCs of the same book, right?
I know how that happens, which is like the sales team sends one out and then the marketing team sends one out. Please, like, you have internal servers. Surely you must be able to cross-reference that list. Surely.
I just...
Be a little bit more intentional, you know?
They are so expensive. They are so expensive. The shipping is expensive. The production's expensive. Like, just don't waste your money. Pay your editorial team a little bit more and only send me one ARC. I had 2 copies of American Dirt for every employee I had at the time that it came out. Like, stop. Yo, make midlist stuff available by smart mailing. Like, it's obscene.
By smart mailing, we also mean using media mail. Stop shipping me free books through UPS. You don't need to pay $10 to ship me something you're not making money on.
People keep sending my bookseller like the overnight express, like, get here by 10:30. Like, you make it by UpsDriver, redo his entire route. It means he doesn't like me, and he's my employee of the month every month. Like, stop.
With ARCs, I tend to get a lot of stuff, and with emails as well, and just, you know, solicitations, where I can tell that they have not looked into my bookstore at all. They didn't even get as far as Space Cowboy, which is pretty obvious what kind of bookstore it is. I'll get a lot of Christian fiction, for instance, or, you know, political poetry or something that's just not going to fit in the store, period. It's not that I have anything against what you're doing, but you're wasting your time and mine. With smaller presses, I do a lot of author events where I interview authors online and in person. I need that ARC on time. If you send it to me 3 days before the event, I've got 3 days to read and the book and prepare an interview. That's a demand on my time that I might not have available. Give me at least 3 weeks, because my TBR stack is like 10 bookshelves long. And a lot of those is work reading, where I'm going to be interviewing these people for magazines or for events. So give me some grace period. You know, if I'm going to write a good, intelligent interview and put on a good event with the proper promotion to help you sell the book as well, give me a little bit of slack there. Another thing with the bigger publishers, when it comes to sending swag, I don't need 1,000 bookmarks for this. I don't have a place to put them. They're going to end up in the garbage. You know, if you want to send me a little bit of promotional material, a poster to put up in the window or something, that's fine. I might use those, but I don't need a giant care package that's just going to get recycled. There's nowhere to do that. the customer doesn't need 500 different bookmarks. They're going to get my bookmark on the way out. So don't overdo it with swag. That's, again, just wasting everybody's time and money.
Send us food. Booksellers don't make money. Send us food.
You know, I've had publishers send me like a box of cookies for Christmas. I love that. also, this doesn't come up very often, but a co-op deal. If I'm going to put on an event and, you know, where I'm spending my time and money to do this and maybe even some advertising, if there's a co-op deal where I'll get a slightly bigger discount on the books, or I can send in an invoice and get that discount, you know, refunded later, that's always really helpful, you know, especially if we're teaming up to put advertising, which can be very expensive. And just keep in mind that, you know, with the events and interviews and things, you know, and I think this is important for booksellers to keep in mind with customers too, or indie authors, for everybody. When you hand someone a book and ask them to read it, you're asking for a commitment of time. You know, this is 6 to 12 hours of someone's time that you're asking for. Respect that. You know, none of us want to get mired down in a book that we don't want to read. You know, the customers don't want to buy it. And just, you know, I had an author come in the store the other day, ask if I'd carry their book. It looked interesting. I said, sure. And they said, I'll give you a month to read that. And I was like, how could you demand my reading time? I'm, you know, most of my reading is slush. You're not going to go to the front of the line. So respect people's time when it comes to that, because it is a time commitment. I'm not Johnny Five. I wish I was, but.
A free recommendation to any. Oh. Well, I was going to say free recommendation to any authors or publicists listening. If you want to work with an independent bookstore, give them 3 to 6 months heads up. Because one, that email isn't going to get answered right away. Two, even if it is, you're going to have to negotiate stuff and figure out a plan. Three, they need time to actually get your book into the store. So if you only give them a week or two head notice, they can maybe do that, but they won't be able to promote anything the way it needs to get done. So you've got to think ahead. Lily?
So I kind of lost the original conceit of your question because I heard half of it and I had immediate thought and then it just like pinged off.
Into, I will remind you because I know exactly what you want to talk about, which is my original thought was, what do you want to see publishing change and adapt to, over the next, in your ideal world? So for me, a lot of that would also be decentering the priority on pre-orders and front list, because backlist sells and is right there and beautiful. And I believe you have a similar answer, but with a very different angle.
Very different angle. Fandom is very important to me, has been throughout my entire life. And I think what book publicity and publishing needs to realize is, because of TikTok, especially, like Instagram to a certain degree, and as we've found out in the past 2 weeks, Twitter. If like bookstores are inundated with arcs, like if you got that many babbles, booktubers and book influencers and like the fandom of RF Kuang would murder somebody for a babble arc. And that's where you need to do your research and really understand the power of community fandom, as we have all seen in the past 2 weeks with This Is How You Lose the Time War. TikTok caught my entire bookstore and my staff by surprise. We were not expecting it. We still sell mountains of Colleen Hoover and things like that. But when I say no one in this industry was expecting Bigalus Dickalus, and there's like sheer amount of just the way that has moved this book, I don't think anyone was ready for it. And it really speaks to how much genuine fandom and a love of books, a love of reading, a love of, and then like the responding, like love of silliness, the love of batshitness, that moves people, and that moves people to buy things and gets money into the ecosystem and into big publishers' pockets. So I think that's where they need to focus, is like, yeah, bookstores are great and wonderful, and we are fans just as much as anyone else. But if you're really paying attention to social media and all those things, you're going to also be paying attention to the sheer love of it, that, you know, bookstores are inundated trying to run a business. So sometimes you have to look outside the industry pipeline to really move your things.
And I think, so for those of you who might have missed the story of Bigalus Dickalus, what happened was a huge anime fan on Twitter recommended This Is How to Lose the Time War, basically saying, don't look up anything about this book, just go and listen to it. Go listen to the audiobook, go read it. And because they were so respected within their fandom community, everybody did, and then everybody started talking about how good it was, which made more people go and get it. For me, the biggest thing about book sales and this industry as a whole, right, is that it comes down to passion. If you're promoting the biggest book just because it's the biggest book, we can tell, and our readers who come into our bookstores can tell the difference between the book that we ordered 50 of because the publisher told us to, and the book we have a stack of 10 of because we love it down to our bones. And I think more than in any other space, we see that in sci-fi fantasy. We see that with the success of niche books like This Is How You Lose the Time War, or the success of Gideon the Ninth, right? Where a book that has a premise that is not necessarily seen as the most marketable takes off because people love it and are passionate about it. And finding ways to connect us booksellers and us booksellers to connect readers to those passions and those things that we love most. I think that's what makes this industry and our role in it so very special.
So we are certainly not in it for the money.
Certainly not in it for the money.
I might add too that if you want to work in genre fiction at all, ignoring fandom is a devastating mistake. There's such a rich fan culture. Fans talk to each other, editors talk to each other, booksellers talk to each other. This is a community, you know, and you don't want to get blacklisted by being a jerk in that way. You know, I regularly speak to other editors at magazines and, you know, names come up. So, you know, embrace your fan community and know that it is a community that interacts and speaks to each other. And that goes for positive things, too. Hey, you're going to love this book. Hey, this author is awesome to work with. Good news travels fast, too.
All we ever want to do is talk about the things we love. With that in mind, we've hit our hour mark, so I'm going to start to wrap it up. But before we go, we, of course, need book recommendations from everybody. So what is a sci-fi fantasy book that you want everybody to go and read right now, or pre-order, or go find in their backlist file somewhere in their house?
Oh, God, you're going to make us only pick one?
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
To start, just to start. And then we'll plug social media and you can give a whole list for people there. But one to start, or we'll be here a whole nother hour. Or two, if you can do two quickly. Do you want me to start? Would that help everybody?
Yes.
All right, I'm going to do two really quickly. One, pre-order Starling House by Alex Harrow, which comes out on Halloween. I want you to pre-order it because it is the perfect spooky book mood. But because Halloween is a Tuesday this year, for some reason, every publisher put the spooky books on Halloween instead of at the beginning of the month. It is an Appalachian horror that is an ode to the power of children's books and imagination, and is also super creepy and has a living haunted house in it. It's great. The other book I would super recommend, and this is entirely biased for my own reasons, I've been reading backlist 90s and 2000s children's literature for my podcast, and have gone back and I am rereading the Artemis Fowl series, and it still holds up, which I was not expecting. So if you would like to go and read a no-pressure, easy escapist book from 20 years ago, Artemis Fowl. Who wants to go next?
I have three, if that's okay.
Rapid fire, let's do it.
All right, so one is actually a pretty old book in the industry's mind. It's like 10 years old at this point, but the author recently republished it himself. So it's Between Two Fires by Christopher Buhlmann. I just read this. It is like incredibly strange and unsettling horror fantasy. The basic premise is it's like the 1360s and the biblical apocalypse starts happening. It's incredibly, incredibly good, but also incredibly harrowing. For one that came out recently, I recommend The Spear Cuts Through Water by Simon Jimenez pretty much every time I get an opportunity to. It's a really, really excellently written fantasy novel that uses some pretty standard genre tropes of, you know, adventure fantasy, but in a really interesting way to do some, I think, really fascinating commentary on colonialism, on history, and on like masculinity in a way that I don't see a lot in fantasy. And then the third one isn't coming out until 2024, but I just finished an arc of The West Passage by Jared Pechacek, I believe is how you pronounce his last name. He's an illustrator on, you might have seen his work. He does interesting drawings of things that are kind of like weird angels. And he's written a book that is very similar to his illustrations. And it's hard to describe, but it's a bit like if you took Gormenghast, combined it with illuminated manuscripts and the weird medieval guy's Twitter account, and then like told a really good coming of age story in that milieu. And it's just great, like super creative. I'm really excited for it to come out, and I hope it does really well.
So I'm going to actually continue with a theme here. I just read Black Tongue Thief by Christopher Buhlmann. As I mentioned at the beginning, I cut my teeth on David Eddings, and I've been chasing that high for like months. I've been like, I just want a quest. I just want a weird group of people going on an adventure to save the world. And Black Tongue Thief is that, but like without feeling derivative. And I haven't been excited about a book the same way I've been excited about Black Tongue Thief in ages. Also, I'd be a failure as a person if I didn't tell everyone here to read All Systems Red by Martha Wells, which is the book that has left me most seen as a person in probably the last decade.
Whenever people ask about my favorite books, I'm like, oh my God, do you have all day? I'm going to try and do this really quick. I'd be remiss not to mention that we publish books, science fiction anthologies of all contemporary science fiction authors. Those are wonderful, of course. Some books that came out in the last couple of years that I've absolutely loved. Alex, An AI's Guide to Love and Murder by Brent A. Harris. He's a local author. It's a fantastic sort of coming of age story about an AI house that goes wrong after it falls in love. Beautiful, beautiful story. Stellar Instinct by Jonathan Nevers is a wonderful spy-fi thriller. He does wonderful world building. You know, if you want action in space with secret agents, fantastic book. Marie Vibert's Galactic Hellcats, her debut novel. It's about an all-girl biker gang in space. I mean, come on, how is that not awesome, right? I want to plug a few older books, too, because I also carry secondhand and I try and carry all eras of science fiction. Walter Tevis, The Man Who Fell to Earth. If you like crying at the end of a book like I do, that book will just make you weep. One of the best books about being human. David Gerald's The Man Who Folded Himself, one of the most bonkers, insane time travel stories I've ever heard. The Einstein Intersection by Samuel Delaney. If you like prosody, beautiful, beautiful writing and musicality and language, highly recommend that.
I have two right next to me. This is probably my favorite fantasy series of all time at the moment in my life. I spoke to the author because of Nicole's podcast, so big plug to Miss Shelves, and thank you, Nicole. But if you like anime, if you like MCU, if you like just good action, I can't recommend Jade City enough. I adore it. And then real quick, this one, in my opinion, is an underrated darling, Vampire Weekend, but hang on, wait for it. Vampire Weekend by Mike Chen. It's another urban fantasy, because that's my favorite, and it's an ode to music. And even though it's about like vampires and it takes place in like foggy San Francisco, it's a feel-good read. It's about like found family and the power of music, and I adore it, and I wish more people would buy it.
Half of those I knew about, and half of those I now need to go read immediately. So thank you for that. All right, we are going to wrap it up. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Meg, JT, Jean-Paul, Lily, can you tell people where to find you on the internet, where to find your bookstore, where to get books from you?
I have mostly broken up with the internet personally, and it's the best thing I've ever done. But if you would like to talk to my bookstore, we are at Copper Dog Books everywhere, and we are copperdogbooks.com.
I'm on pretty much all of the social platforms as either Jeremy T-E-G or Jeremy T-E-G-R-O. Antti's Bookstore is my bookstore, and they're on Twitter at Antti's Books. And, you know, if you order copies of my stuff from them, I will happily sign it and, like, draw things in the front matter if you want.
The thing I love most is when people come into the bookstore so we can say hi and talk in person. So if you find yourself in Joshua Tree, town's only 3 blocks long, easy to find us. You can also find us at Space Cowboy Books online. We're on Twitter and Instagram and all that, of course. No Facebook, though. We also have a YouTube channel where we have a wealth of interviews and readings from authors from all over the world. And then our podcast, Simultaneous Times, if you want to hear some contemporary science fiction, that can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts.
I work at Harvard Bookstore, not the Coop, not the Co-op. That one's owned by Barnes & Noble, and they sell T-shirts. We are Harvard Bookstore. We're on Massachusetts Avenue. For me personally, I'm on Twitter, Lily_RUGO. Everything else of mine is just not very active or private. But that's, yeah, mostly you just find me at the bookstore.
And as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm Nicole Brinkley. You can find my bookstore, Oblong Books, at oblongbooks.com or at Oblong Books on pretty much any platform. You can also find me at N.E. Brinkley on Instagram. And if you like hearing me talk about books or to booksellers, you can hit up my old podcast, Misshelved, where both Meg and Lily had chances to talk to Martha Wells and Fonda Lee, respectively. And I'm also doing a new podcast now called Novelstalgia, where I read 90s and 2000s children's books with one of my best friends and New York Times bestselling author, Ashley Poston. And I do a bunch of other things on the internet. If you go follow me on Instagram, you'll see. Thank you so much to Adrian for letting us take over for a little more than an hour to talk about indie bookselling stuff. And thank you to everybody who listened to the live stream and is listening in the future. Hello. Thank you. You're amazing. Goodbye, everybody. And thank you so much to our wonderful panelists. Have a great day.